For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm producer Robert Kirkwood, and coming up this week,
Eleanor Wasserberg talks about her new novel, The Light at the End of the Day, and discusses sibling rivalry.
Former director of the British Museum, Neil McGregor, talks about being inspired by a painting.
We dive into our Star Wars features collection.
And we've got Books of Your Life from a former winner of the Booker Prize. That's all coming up in today's show.
Eleanor Wasserberg's debut novel, Foxlow, was a highly acclaimed gothic thriller that was inspired by the North Staffordshire countryside in which she grew up. Her follow-up, The Light at the End of the Day, was inspired by real events that occurred in her family during the Second World War. Here she is to tell us more.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Your new book, The Light at the End of the Day, was inspired, well, by a painting and your family history.
Yes, well, by both. They're sort of connected. So there is a real painting called Portrait of Girl in a Red Dress, which is by Josef Pankowitz and hangs in the National Museum in Kielce in Poland. And that portrait is of my great aunt, who was called Josefa Odefeld. And the story is spun out of a completely fictionalized account of the creation of that painting and what happens to Josefa, who becomes Alicia in my book, and the rest of the family, and indeed the painter afterwards. I fudged lots of things. I moved things around. The painting was actually done in the late 1800s, and I've shifted it forward 30 years or so to fit my purposes. I had a huge poster of the painting above my desk when I was writing, and the descriptions of the painting, it is that painting that I'm writing about.
And can you describe the painting for the Connect Radio listeners?
It's an odd painting in that, on first glance, the thing that strikes you is this red. There's this incredibly, it's called Portrait of Girl in a Red Dress, and there's this incredibly rich, deep red of this billowing dress that Josefa is wearing. So it's the colour that strikes you first. She's standing with her hand on a chair. There's not much going on in the background. The centre of the painting is this bright red dress that she's wearing. She has this really curious expression on her face. It's one of those paintings where the longer you look at it, the more you can find in it. So sometimes if you catch the face at certain angles, it looks quite sulky, and she's by all accounts quite a sulky little girl, quite spoiled. But other times she looks really wise, and she's got almost like a Mona Lisa smile. It's very difficult to read the expression, so it's quite fascinating. And for me, it's really a symbol of a whole world that was lost. That was the aspect of it that really struck me as a writer that I wanted to try and capture in the book, that the painting stands for something, as well as being a really beautiful object in itself, and it is. It represents something as well, that world that's gone.
Because your great-grandparents' family were very much part of the establishment and, well, would have considered themselves to have been very safe.
I certainly think they did. So my great-grandfather, Ignazi, who the book is dedicated to, he was actually safe in Switzerland. He'd managed to get out of Krakow and he was safe in Switzerland, and he completely inexplicably went to Paris in 1942. Imagine, as a Jewish man, just went to Paris, and I've never understood why. And we think maybe he was trying to sell a property, but that says to me, even in the middle of the war, he felt safe. And he had a lot of cash on him. One of the really horrifying things about the regime, but that's also really helpful to historians, is that so much is recorded and written down. And it's in his arrest warrants. There's a huge amount of money he had on him, which, of course, was just taken. And I sometimes wonder if he just felt, I'm rich, they won't touch me. And there's something so horrifying about that false sense of security. And I've always found that a really horrifying detail, that he was safe and he put himself in danger in that way. But yeah, certainly before the war, I think they were quite establishment. I've amalgamated the families in the novel really unhelpfully for people who are trying to tease out what's real and what's not. But the Wasserbergs and the Odefelds were both well off, upper middle class, artsy, liberal, Jewish world. And I think they probably did feel quite safe. I talk in the book about the impact that things like Kristallnacht had on that community in Krakow and how people started to worry. But the kind of natural thing, I think, in communities is you don't want to seem to be panicking and hysterical. And our natural instinct is to feel safe and to think it won't happen to us, and to think that's in Germany, it won't happen here. And if it does happen here, it'll happen to other people. And we see that all the time, don't we?
And after the event, I think also there is a temptation not to talk about such horrific things. And it's certainly been a spur to you to write this book that maybe you didn't ask your grandfather as many questions as you could whilst he was still alive.
Absolutely. Yes. As a child, your grandparents are just your grandparents, aren't they? And they're not really real people with histories and childhoods and things. So that kind of natural selfishness of a child and a young teenager definitely is responsible for that. But also Yesha, George, we called him, he didn't really ever talk about it except in very, very occasional little things that were dropped in. But certainly there was a strong feeling in that generation that you didn't speak to children about horrific things, but also that you just had to carry on, that the world had nearly ended, it felt like, and there was this new chance. And so you just kept facing forward, was the feeling that I got from both of my grandparents, actually. So my nan had suffered a lot in the war as well, in a different way. She wasn't a Holocaust survivor, but she had really suffered. And everyone had suffered so much. And there was a lot of people maybe of my age, their memories of the grandparents might be the same, that you just don't talk about that, that's over. And by the time I became really interested, he had died. And what was really heartbreaking is that my parents, I think, realising that he had all of these incredible stories we'd never really done anything about, interviewed him when he was in his early 90s, knowing that he didn't have much longer to live. And they made tapes and asked him about life before the war and during the war, as much as he was happy to talk about what happened to Ignazi, what happened to Carolina, who were his parents, what happened to him. And all the tapes have been lost. I think they were lost in a house move. And my dad had kept saying to me, oh, you must listen to these. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe the book is all of a long apology to Yesha, really, for not listening properly and not listening to those tapes.
Well, as far as a work of fiction is concerned, it is very rich and full of imagination that really brings the story to light. Maybe a transcript of what had been written might not be quite so entertaining, but one of the things that I found really fascinating about the book was that it's also a tale of two sisters, the girl in the red dress and her sister, who, without giving any spoilers, took a major part in the family story.
Yes, I was so interested in Carolina, and she isn't the subject of the painting. And when I was researching the painting, I went out to Krakow and I met with the head of the museum out there, the gallery that I mentioned in Kielce. And he knows a lot about the family, and he was able to tell me about my family. And he said Josefa was really the favourite in a really serious way. And there aren't really portraits of Carolina, except one where she's with their mother. And I thought, gosh, how interesting that there's quite an interesting psychological thing there in terms of what is it like when there's such an obvious favourite with her father, and how would that play out in the relationship between the sisters? And I was really keen that it wouldn't just be that they're rivals, that they also really love each other, and that the war just simplifies everything, that there's quite a messy family dynamic that's set up. But actually, when you're in a situation of being a refugee, of survival, of that confusion, that they really cling to each other. I put things in the book that were just the product of me ruminating on it, really. How much would they have really touched each other before in a family like that? And actually, on the road, and once this cataclysm has happened, they're literally clinging to each other. And Anna, the mother, has never been so close to her daughters, and they find each other. Those relationships between the mother and the sisters are really made by this experience. I'm not really ever conscious of these things as I'm writing, but it's a theme that was in my first book as well. I guess I'm just really interested in sisterhood and mothers and daughters.
Well, as you say, it's something you explore in the relationship between the two young girls, Green and Blue, who are in this cult in Foxlow, your first novel. And in some ways, it's their rivalry for love and attention that causes the strain between them, but also gives them an awful lot in common.
Yes, that's the heart of the sibling relationship, isn't it, I suppose? Even in the happiest families, that you are rivals in a really primal way for your parents' attention and resources. And but also that means there's no one else who understands you in the same way as your siblings. It's only people that you've grown up with, really, isn't it? And siblings you've grown up with in that day-to-day in the same house way that really, really know the core of you, is my experience anyway. My siblings know me in a way that no one else does, and I know them in a way that no one else does. And it's something about that tension when you're growing up, it's almost like you're testing out all of your emotions on your siblings. I remember just feeling overwhelmed with hatred sometimes for my siblings. And yet also there's no one I love like them. So it is a really fascinating relationship to me.
And the location of Foxlow really puts that in the pressure cooker. It's a utopian cult gone awry.
Gone very awry.
With a very overbearing cult leader. It's a remarkably spooky book and led me to look up the surroundings of the North Staffordshire area you write about, Leek and Endon and places like that, which are full of very ancient history.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a really ancient landscape. And it's great because it's a wonderful secret. Everyone knows about Stonehenge and that part of our landscape. But yeah, that part of North Staffordshire is full of pagan sites. Stone circles, burial mounds, burial chambers, and it's very spooky. There's not really any tourists there. There's the odd walker. The standing stones in the novel is partly based on a pagan stone circle site called Ludchurch that has this incredible effect on the summer solstice where the sun shines right through the stones. And the experience of being there is incredibly spooky and numinous. And I profess to be a complete atheist. And yet when I'm in places like that, I can understand how people believe in spirits because there is something about very ancient trees, very ancient woodlands, ancient moorland, ancient stones. There's something spooky about that.
That sense of something hovering on the edge of your sight really, well, it fills both your books, either the ghosts of the dead of the Holocaust or the ghosts of pagan people past in Foxlow. And I believe that it's something that you're researching for your next book as well in a way that certainly chimes with me and I think will chime with other people who have been slowly losing their sight.
Yeah, so I'm researching at the moment Charles Bonnet syndrome and I find it absolutely fascinating. And it's funny how you just don't see things in your own work. I suppose I do always write about hauntings and not knowing whether to trust your senses and things being just on the edge of your vision. I do write about that a lot. I was thinking I was writing something completely new, but it's the same thing. A few years ago, there was an exhibition here in Norwich called Seeing Things, and it was organised by a local charity. It might have been the RNIB, a local branch of it, that organised it. And my school got involved, and it was about Charles Bonnet syndrome. And I had a group of creative writers I was working with who came to respond to the exhibition. What they did was they matched up a local artist with someone who experiences Charles Bonnet syndrome. And they spoke about what visions they had. And then the artist created an artist impression of what they were seeing. And it was the most incredible exhibition. It really stayed with me and really inspired me. And that's where I think I'll be going with my next project. There's so much richness there in terms of the range of people's experience that sometimes it seems like it's a really terrifying experience. There was a man who saw faces coming out of the wall and it was really nightmarish. And sometimes really whimsical and fun. There's a woman who was talking about she would see dancing cats just going across her field of vision. And sometimes like just a herd of elephants walking through the room and she would find it really funny and said that if it ever leaves, she'll miss it. I just thought that idea of whether or not you can trust what you see and being locked into your own perception in that way and trying to explain it to someone else and them not really understanding it or only being able to imagine it is really fascinating for its own sake, but it's also really rich fodder for fiction. I can imagine how you might play that out. And I'm in a very early stage with this new project. I haven't really even got any characters yet, but it'd be really interesting within a relationship that so much of our negotiation within a relationship is, can you see things my way? Can you understand how I see the world? And I think that would be a really interesting way in to explore a relationship if one person had this syndrome as the incredible brain fills in the gaps, if you like. And I just think it leads to lots of interesting ideas about what we see and don't see and what's really there. And ghosts. There was a talk at this exhibition that I went to, Seeing Things. And it was a very serious talk by serious doctors. And then I kept saying, but doesn't that explain ghosts and ghost stories? Because what you described really sounds like a ghost story. And they would dismiss it and say, that's not really interesting. We're talking about how the eye works. But it seems to be where a lot of ghost stories might come from. There's stories of people walking into walls and vanishing and talking to people in period costume and thinking there must be some kind of TV show being filmed. And then there's no one there. It's really fascinating.
Well, that certainly echoes my own experience of Charles Bonnet syndrome. And I believe that there is sight loss in your own family as well.
Well, my nan had glaucoma. This is the grandmother who was married to Yesha. And again, it's interesting to me now thinking about it that she just never talked about it. She never confided in us what that experience was like. She was very much of that generation of don't complain and get on with it. And she was a really talented seamstress and a hairdresser by trade. But she made the most beautiful dresses and things for us when we were children. And it was a real source of pain to her that she couldn't do that anymore. As her sight deteriorated, that was something that she had to stop. And I think that was really hard for her. But I'm speculating because she never talked about it.
Was she able to carry on enjoying books by listening to talking books?
She listened to the radio an awful lot. Did she listen to audiobooks? I think she must have done because she was a big reader. We did used to talk about books a lot. And again, I think she first switched to the bigger print books. And then, yes, I'm sure she would have used audiobooks as things got harder.
And both your novels have been turned into terrific audiobooks.
Yes.
Foxlow narrated by Charlie Sanderson.
Yes, she's wonderful. Actually, it's the only time that I've interfered at all as an author. They'd chosen a reader for the audiobook and she was great, but it was just completely the wrong accent. And I really wanted someone who had a Staffordshire accent to do it, who said grass, not grass, and things like that. It was just weirdly important to me. So I said, can you please find someone who could do that? And they found Charlie and she's amazing.
And The Light at the End of the Day is recorded by Kate Sorby.
Yes, also fantastic. Yeah, they've managed to find voices that really sound right, actually. It's strange. I think as the author, you always just imagine yourself. You hear your own voice. But yeah, I think they've really managed to cast it very well.
Janina Cardus was navigating her way towards the Odefeld apartment in the strangely cheerful sunshine of early afternoon. She wore her best clothes, a fur hat and a heavy winter coat, beautifully tailored with a matching ermine trim. The coat and hat were too warm for early September in the city, but she wished to display herself today as a woman of obvious good breeding. She remembered snatches of German refugee tales, how people were stopped in the street. She imagined herself seized, accosted, jostled, until the attacker, in some kind of uniform, noticed her coat, her hat, and looked then into her delicately lined face. Not young or pretty enough to be in danger, she comforted herself, but somehow authoritative. He would step back, uneasy, for surely she knew people. Surely her husband was someone of importance. And Janina's imaginary self sneered a little, tugged her clothing back into place, patted her hat back onto its perch, and strode away. Janina passed the shuttered bakery. 2 weeks ago, the baker had been holding forth yet again, lectures that war was coming. It had been the same for weeks, pastries and doom, and she was irritated by it. The shelves and displays had all been empty that day, and upstairs, heavy footsteps had dragged heavier furniture.
"You're leaving?"
"It will happen soon," he'd said, chewing the thin lips on his lean face, so wrong for a baker, who really ought to be fat, adding,
"I'm going to Lvov. I'm not sticking around."
"But my rolls and donuts," she had replied.
Kate Sorby, narrating The Light at the End of the Day, written by my guest. Kate Sorby, narrating The Light at the End of the Day, written by my guest, Eleanor Wasserberg. So, Eleanor, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I am, yeah. I really love audiobooks. I've got into running. I'm one of those people who's got into running over lockdown. And I find music really distracting. So when I'm running, I normally love listening to music. But yeah, I've been listening to audiobooks. So I've got through most of Michelle Obama's Becoming whilst trying to become a runner, which has been great. It is a different experience. And I really enjoy that way of experiencing a story. I suppose it's like when people read to you as a child, isn't it? There's something really comforting about having a voice tell you a story in that way.
Now, you're a graduate of the Creative Writing MA at the University of East Anglia, and yes. Now you also teach English at school. What do you think the most important lesson that you have learnt or taught about writing is?
I think, personally, the most important advice I had, or the advice that really changed things for me, was from Giles Bowden, who was one of my teachers on the course. And it was a really simple piece of advice, just to hold your nerve. said it's really easy to falter in the middle of a project and to fall out of love with it, and that you have to hold your nerve and push through to the end. It's a little bit like going for a run, but also you have to hold your nerve before you send things out and just trust that you can get it through another few drafts and you can make it better before you send it out. In terms of what I teach, the advice that I give to the young writers that I work with is obviously to read everything, but also to try not to mimic too much the voices of what you're reading, and to try and navigate to find your own voice, which is the hardest thing as a writer, really. I still sometimes, if I'm reading, if I'm absorbed in something and I'm writing, I'll find that I slip into that style. It's so easy to do. It's like a kind of ventriloquism. So I'll be reading Becoming or something, and suddenly I'll start sounding like Michelle Obama in my sentences. So it's absorbing as much as you can from reading, but also making sure that you're staying really true to the voice that you've created.
And it sounds like you are a writer who finds the first draft the hardest one, and then the revisions actually more creative.
Yeah, I'm such a drama queen about writing. Honestly, I really wish that I could not be, but I live with another writer and he just gets on with it and just does it and doesn't complain about it. And I flounder around. I mean, I'm like a cartoon version of a writer, you know, I'm tearing my hair out, and I wish I could grow up about it, but that is just what I'm like. For me, really, it's always first draft in a way. I make such huge changes right up until the end. Like at the end of the day, I rewrote some of the final chapters just maybe a week or so before I sent it to the publisher to go. I'm just messy as a writer in that I don't really have that process of I get through a first draft and then I go through and I do a character edit, all the things that you're supposed to do. I write a thing and then it's this big mess. And I feel like I'm writing a first draft in a way right up until the very end, which is incredibly stressful, but does seem to be how it works for me. I wish that I could be more methodical about it and have an Excel spreadsheet with what happens in each chapter, but I'm just not.
Well, it's certainly very successful, so probably best not to change the format.
I won't mess with it.
Eleanor Wasserberg, thank you so much for sharing some insights into both your novels with the Read On listeners.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Foxlow and The Light at the End of the Day are available as talking books from the RNIB Library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, as you've just heard, Eleanor Wasserberg says she was inspired by a painting. Well, my next guest has a painting to thank for his whole career. I talked to Neil McGregor when he was still director of the British Museum, about his book and radio show, A History of the World in 100 Objects.
When I was a child growing up in Glasgow, the great event in the museum and art gallery in Glasgow was the acquisition by Glasgow City of Salvador Dali's Christ on the Cross. We were all taken to see it. It's a very remarkable picture because it's painted as though it's very, very realistic. But in fact, what you're looking at is Christ on the cross floating in the heavens. And I remember as a child being very fascinated by this this contrast between something that looked so real and was so obviously impossible.
Mm.
And then, of course, the wonderful thing about museums in Glasgow and everywhere, because in all our big cities, is that because they're free, even as a child, youngster, you could go back and just slowly get to know them.
Now, as the director of the British Museum, are you trying to acquire pieces that inspire other people as much as that painting inspired you?
Yes, the British Museum tries to acquire a lot, because what we're trying to do is really tell the story of humanity from the very beginning to now. And above all, the question of how have different societies organized themselves. So that means, of course, we want to keep collecting contemporary things to look at how society is changing. Obviously, in the Middle East at the moment, you'd want to know how that's changing so that we can look back in 100 years and there are the objects, the same in China, India, whatever. So we collect modern things, but we also want to try to collect great things from the past that will add to the stories we can already tell. So acquiring is quite an important bit.
Now, was it hard to pick just 100 objects?
Oh, it was terrifically difficult. because the museum has millions of objects from all around the world and all through time. So we had to try to choose on the particular set of criteria. And we wanted to start right at the beginning, nearly 2 million years ago, when our ancestors start making tools and start shaping things to use and to look at and come right up to today. So that was one strand. The 100 objects had to cover 2 million years. But we also wanted to keep going around the world at a given moment, so that if you look at the world 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, look at what's happening in India, in Europe, in America, whatever, so that you can go, you can spin the globe at any one point in time and look at what people are doing all around the world.
Now, you touched on this earlier, but it's very important to you that the British Museum, and indeed every museum, should be free.
Yes, that's one of the great traditions about museums in Britain. Parliament set up our museums, beginning with the British Museum, in 1753. And Parliament declared that because these objects were for every citizen and they were about understanding the world, every citizen should have free access to them. And it's been like that for 250 years now. And every big city, every town, really, in the United Kingdom has great collections from all over the world that are open free. It's one of the things that makes living in Britain different from other countries.
Mm. Now, in the history of the world in 100 objects, do you have a favourite?
I do. Well, I've got a couple of favourites because it's always the way. I think, am I allowed two favourites?
Of course you are.
The first is a little sculpture, and you can hold it comfortably in your hand. It's about the size of your fist, and it was made about 10,000-12,000 years ago. It was found near Bethlehem, and it's the oldest known representation we have of a couple making love. And it's a pebble that's just been chipped away so that you have a man and a woman embracing each other. And you hold them in your hand as they hold each other. And there's something very, very beautiful about it, these two people that have become one in the stone. And it's the fact that this is the oldest known representation we have of love like that.
Mm.
I find that very moving, very powerful, as well as being very beautiful. And then jumping to about 500 years ago, there's the drawing, the print by Albrecht Dürer of the first rhinoceros to come to Europe since the fall of the Roman Empire. In 1505, an Indian sultan sends a rhinoceros to the king of Portugal. And it causes a great sensation. And it arrives in Lisbon, everybody talks about it. And Dürer, the artist, is living in Nuremberg in South Germany. And he never sees it. But he's heard so much about it that he tries to draw it. And then he makes a print of it. And I think that's a very, very interesting thing. Because we all want to have an idea in our heads of things we've heard about but haven't actually experienced. And that's a very human desire. And I find that print of the rhinoceros by a man who'd never seen one, but wanted to see one and had heard about it and studied it, that seems to me what a lot of us spend our time doing, trying to make an idea of something we've never actually experienced but want to understand.
I think my favourite in the 100 objects is it's going to be a lot of people's favourite, is the Rosetta Stone.
Oh, well, the Rosetta Stone is, of course, a real favourite, because what is interesting about the story of things is that, of course, they go on doing unexpected tasks long after they've been made and long after the people that have made them have died. So the Rosetta Stone was really a way of publishing a legal agreement between the king of Egypt and the priests, that if the priests supported the king, he would give the temples a tax break. So it's really a kind of budget statement, and it's just as boring. But of course, it was written in three languages. And long after the priests and the king were dead, when it was discovered around 1800 in Egypt, it became, of course, as everybody knows, the basis on which we were at last able to read the hieroglyphics. But I love the fact that that's, of course, not at all what it was made for, and that the people who carved it, everybody involved with it when it was made, would be astonished to think that we were still interested in it and that it had done this totally, totally unexpected thing.
It was, I remember seeing it as a small boy, and not for what it says, but for what it allowed people to do. Just
exactly.
It's an incredible object. It's something I always make go out my way to see, actually, when I'm...
Well, exactly. I remember when I was first brought from Scotland to London, when I was eight, I was brought to see it. And in those days, you were allowed to touch it. And I so remember that excitement of touching the object. And in fact, because now we can't, the original has to be protected in the case, we've made a copy so that it's still possible to touch it. And you can still run your fingers over the inscriptions and feel the Greek letters, which everybody could read and understand, and the Egyptian hieroglyphics, which they were able to discover. Because that chance to touch is such an important thing.
That's a point, actually. We are on RNIB's radio, and many of the objects at the British Museum are behind glass. So what facilities are at the museum for people with no sight?
Well, we've tried to do quite a number of things. As I say, there's the replica of the Rosetta Stone. There's also a replica of some of the Parthenon sculptures, so that people can experience that by touch. But we have, for all our exhibitions and for a number of our galleries, we've got Braille books and large print books. So that the information about the objects is available. And we run regular, for everybody, all members of the public, we have objects that are out in the galleries to be handled, because quite a lot of the objects in the museum are actually very tough. And you only put them in a case to stop people walking away with them. There's no reason why they shouldn't be handled. So in a number of galleries, we've got desks, and the volunteers help us do this, where visitors can come and touch the objects and feel them, hold them, feel the weight, how they fit into their hand, how they're made. And we have, that's for all the public all the time. But we also have special handling sessions for blind and partially sighted visitors. At regular moments as well. So we try to allow as much touch as possible.
Accessible to everyone and free of charge.
Exactly.
A History of the World in 100 Objects is available from RNIB Talking Books. And of course, the print version is available wherever books are sold. Neil McGregor, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Still to come, we've got Bernardine Evaristo's Books of Her Life. And in a moment, I'll be finding out the links between the RNIB Talking Books Studios and Star Wars. But first, let's hear from Talking Books narrator Ray Sawyer.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you've got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book Studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway in the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour. And was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later, she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the talking books because, well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Talking Book Service from RNIB has approximately 350 professional narrators, and currently, amongst that number, is an X-Wing pilot, a Star Destroyer commander, a junk dealer from the planet Tatooine, and even an Ewok. In the library, you'll also find books written by Jedis and read by droids, and one regular narrator from back in the day once commanded the first Death Star. The X-Wing pilot goes by the name of Gary Kagan, who has read over 100 talking books and who also now runs his own audio production company, The Story Circle, directing people reading books like Ian McKellen, Hugh Laurie, Julie Walters, Philip Pullman and Joan Collins. He told me about his part in Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope.
Well, my part as it exists is a brief stint as Big Darklighter in the attack on the Death Star and just before in the hangar scene. But Biggs originally, and for those who know the book, is Luke Skywalker's best friend and sort of like an older brother, really. So there is a scene that you can find on the CD, not the DVD, but the CD-ROM called Behind the Magic, and all over the web, of course. A scene with Luke right at the beginning of the film when I'm trying to get him to come and join the Rebel Academy.
Gary Kagan talking about his role or lack thereof in Star Wars. His IMDb entry not only lists Star Wars, but many others such as Mission Impossible, Doctor Who and James Bond. And alongside his wife, Liza Ross, they played the parents of a young Bruce Wayne in Tim Burton's Batman. Although, if you know the story, they weren't in the movie for very long. His distinctive voice lends itself to American classics, such as The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which he lists as his favourite book that he's ever read, and also adds magic to narration of books by the master of horror, Stephen King.
Tom, we came to ask you if you could help us.
Me? Help? Sure, I'd love to help.
This is dangerous, Tom. We want you to go west and then come back and tell us what you saw.
Okay, sure,
Tom said without the slightest hesitation. But Stu thought he saw a momentary shadow cross Tom's face and linger behind his guileless blue eyes.
When?
Stu put a gentle hand on Tom's neck and wondered what in the hell he was doing here. How were you supposed to figure these things out if you weren't Mother Abigail and didn't have a hotline to heaven?
Pretty soon now, he said gently. Pretty soon.
Gary Kagan reading one of the many Stephen King books available from RNIB Talking Books. Another golden voice in the Talking Book studio, and like Garrick, has read hundreds of books, belongs to Jonathan Oliver, who, in Return of the Jedi, was Star Destroyer Commander number 2.
The 100 million self-confident German masters were to be brutally installed in Europe. and secured in power by a monopoly of technical civilization and the slave labor of a dwindling native population of neglected, diseased, illiterate cretins, in order that they might have leisure to buzz along infinite Autobahnen, admire the Strength Through Joy Hostel, the party headquarters, the military museum, and the planetarium, which their Führer would have built in Linz, his new Hitleropolis.
Jonathan Oliver reading Fatherland by Robert Harris. A book set in a world that almost existed, a world in which the Nazis won World War II. Hitler is a very old man, and Xavier March is investigating the murder of a man found floating in a lake.
He says you don't give the Führer salute, and you make jokes about the party. And how does he know all this? He says there's a file on you at party headquarters, and it's only a matter of time before you're picked up. The boy was almost in tears with the shame of it. I think he's right.
The voice there of Jonathan Oliver. And finally, Anthony Daniels, the actor behind, or rather the actor inside, droid C-3PO, is the voice of Vlad the Drac.
I told you he was after blood, said Paul. Come on, let's get out of here. Why did you faint? Asked Judy.
He promised you won't tell, said the baby vampire, looking tearful.
Of course, said Judy. Go on, Paul, promise.
All right, muttered Paul dubiously.
When Paul and Judy accompany their parents on a sightseeing holiday in Romania, they are bored stiff until they find a baby vampire under a stone. Is he the last of his kind? They smuggle him into England, disguised as a souvenir. But no sooner have they reached their home than the trouble starts.
Well, the truth is, I'm a very bad vampire. I faint at the sight of blood, confessed the vampire, blushing and looking at his feet. In fact, I'm a vegetarian.
The voice there of Anthony Daniels narrating Vlad the Drac, one of the many books in the Talking Books library with a connection to the Star Wars saga. The Talking Book service is now free and easier than ever to join. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. And with the Booker Prize almost upon us, let's hear from last year's joint winner, Bernardine Evaristo. Bernardine, was there a book that you read as a child that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I don't remember any book making me want to become an author because I wasn't thinking about that at the time, but I wanted to be an actor, and that was my first career. But the book that made perhaps the biggest impression on me is actually a radio play, Under Milkwood, by Dylan Thomas. And we did a production of it at school, which is how I was introduced to it, and I absolutely loved it. I loved the orality of it. I loved the characters, these kind of quirky characters. I loved the humour. I loved how he was able to convey this tiny little Welsh fishing village in a few words. And it was definitely later, I can see, the seminal influence on the kind of writing style that I would eventually develop.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat, there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush! The babies are sleeping. The farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobbler, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the web-foot cockle women and the tidy wives. Young girls lie bedded soft or glide in their dreams with rings and trousseau, bridesmaided by glowworms down the aisles of the organ-playing wood. The boys are dreaming wicked, or of the bucking ranches of the night and the jolly Rogered Sea, and the anthracite statues of the horses sleep in the fields, and the cows in the byres, and the dogs in the wet-nosed yards, and the cats nap in the slant corners, or lope sly, streaking and needling on the one cloud of the roofs. You can hear the dew falling, and the hushed town breathing. Only your eyes are unclosed to see the black and folded town fast and slow asleep. And you alone can hear the invisible starfall, the darkest before dawn minutely dew-gray stir of the black, dab-filled sea, where the Arethusa, the Curlew, and the Skylark, Zanzibar, Rhiannon, the Rover, the Cormorant, and the Star of Wales tilt and rise. Listen. It is night moving in the streets, the processional salt slow musical wind in Coronation Street and Cockle Row. It is the grass growing on Llareggub Hill, dewfall, starfall, the sleep of birds in Milkwood. Look, it is night dumbly, royally winding through the coronation cherry trees, going through the graveyard of Bethesda with winds gloved and folded and dew-doffed, tumbling by the sailor's arms. Time passes. Listen. Time passes. Come closer now. Only you can hear the houses sleeping in the streets in the slow, deep, salt and silent black bandaged night. Only you can see in the blinded bedrooms the combs and petticoats over the chairs, the jugs and basins, the glasses of teeth thou shalt not on the wall, and the yellowing dicky bird watching pictures of the dead. Only you can hear and see behind the eyes of the sleepers the movements and countries and mazes and colors and dismays and rainbows and tunes and wishes and flight and fall and despairs and big seas of their dreams. From where you are, you can hear their dreams.
Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB20490, which is narrated by Richard Burton and Sean Phillips. Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
So many books. I think I'm going to go for Ben Okri, The Famished Road. He won the Booker, of course. I think it was in 1991. Nigerian writer. And I don't remember much about the novel, to be honest. I read it once, but I absolutely loved it. And I remember the sensation of reading something that to me was so extraordinarily brilliant. I couldn't put it down. I was in awe of his prose style, of his imagination, of his ability to convey this Nigerian spirit world that he writes about. And I'd like to revisit it and see what I think today.
In the beginning, there was a river. The river became a road, and the road branched out to the whole world. And because the road was once a river, it was always hungry. In that land of beginnings, spirits mingled with the unborn. We could assume numerous forms. Many of us were birds. We knew no boundaries. There was much feasting, playing, and sorrowing. We feasted much because of the beautiful terrors of eternity. We played much because we were free. And we sorrowed much because there were always those amongst us who had just returned from the world of the living. They had returned inconsolable for all the love they had left behind, all the suffering they hadn't redeemed, all that they hadn't understood, and for all that they had barely begun to learn before they were drawn back to the land of origins. There was not one amongst us who looked forward to being born. We disliked the rigors of existence, the unfulfilled longings, the enshrined injustices of the world, the labyrinths of love, the ignorance of parents, the fact of dying, and the amazing indifference of the living in the midst of the simple beauties of the universe. We feared the heartlessness of human beings, all of whom are born blind, few of whom ever learn to see. Our king was a wonderful personage who sometimes appeared in the form of a great cat. He had a red beard and eyes of greenish sapphire. He had been born uncountable times and was a legend in all worlds, known by 100 different names. It never mattered into what circumstances he was born. He always lived the most extraordinary of lives. One could pore over the great invisible books of lifetimes and recognize his genius through the recorded and unrecorded ages. Sometimes a man, sometimes a woman, he wrought incomparable achievements from every life. If there is anything common to all of his lives, the essence of his genius, it might well be the love of transformation and the transformation of love into higher realities. With our spirit companions, the ones with whom we had a special affinity, we were happy most of the time because we floated on the aquamarine air of love. We played with the fauns, the fairies, and the beautiful beings, tender sibyls, benign sprites, and the serene presences of our ancestors were always with us, bathing us in the radiance of their diverse rainbows. There are many reasons why babies cry when they are born, and one of them is the sudden separation from the world of pure dreams, where all things are made of enchantment, and where there is no suffering.
The Famished Road by Ben Ockrey is available in a full range of accessible formats from the library, including as TB9219, narrated by Ben Onukwe. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I read Ghost Wall by Sarah Moss recently, and it's a very short book, but my God, it packs a punch. I don't want to say too much about it because I don't want to give anything away, but it's about a girl whose father is a sort of Iron Age enthusiast, and he takes his daughter and his wife to a remote part of the country to kind of reenact an Iron Age way of living. And through this, we get a sense of how people lived during the Iron Age. But there's so much going on with that book, and it's thrilling and it's shocking. It brings the Iron Age alive in some ways, but it's also about a guy who wants to feel a sense of belonging to a Britain before immigration. But, of course, that's not true because Britain has always been settled by immigrants. So that's also something in the book. But it's also about her relationship with her father and her mother and some other people who get involved in this Iron Age reenactment. And I think it's a really magical book.
They bring her out. Not blindfolded, but eyes widened to the last sky, the last light. The last cold bites her fingers and her face. The stones bruise her bare feet. There will be more stones before the end. She stumbles. They hold her up. No need to be rough. Everyone knows what is coming. From deep inside her body, from the cord in her spine and the wide bloodways under the ribs, from the emptiness of her womb and the rising of her chest, she shakes. A body in fear. They lead the fearful body over the turf and along the track. her bare feet numb to most of the pain of rock and sharp rushes. Chanting rises. The drums sound slow, unsyncopated with the last panic of her heart. Others follow, wrapped against the cold, dark figures processing into the dusk. On arrival, they strip her. It is easy. They've put her into a loose tunic. Against the low red light of the winter sunset, her body is white as chalk, solid against the wisps of fog and the tracery of reed. She tries to cover herself with her hands and is not allowed. One holds her while the other binds her. Her breathing is accelerated, its condensation settling on her face. Exhaled breaths hang like spirits above each person's head, slowly dissolving into the air. The men turn her to face the crowd. They display her to her neighbours and her family, to the people who held her hands as she learnt to walk, taught her to dip her bread in the pot and wipe her lips, to weave a basket and gut a fish. She's played with the children who now peep at her from behind their mothers, has murmured prayers for them as they were being born. She has been one of them, ordinary.
Ghost Wall by Sarah Moss is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Christine Hewitt. Bernadine Evaristo, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.